are we doing? Materialism, as it affects the problem of immortality, leaves us with absolutely nothing worth doing. There is no more reason why we should be great than that we should become a wino and wander around spending our weekends in the county jail. It all means nothing. Because in oblivion there is neither a preferred group nor an unpreferred group. What is it all going? Where is it all going? Everybody thought in Russia that they were doing a very unkind trick to Stalin when they took his remains away from his partner in the Kremlin. But if they're correct, he doesn't even know it. He never will know it. And in a few years, they will not know they did it. Most discouraging. So science has to do something about this. Because science can never maintain an ethical universe with nothing going anywhere or coming from anywhere. We cannot face any human hope. We cannot give the human being anything to build on. If we make him a little spot of biological life in a universe of eternal terminations. So as soon as he gets through trying to figure out whether the universe has an intelligent principle in it or not, he's got to begin thinking about what this intelligent principle might have planned for its creatures rather than what he thinks it planned. And if science comes to the conclusion, which it is coming to so rapidly that it'll probably be here within 4 or 5 years, that this universe is ruled over by an eternal conscious principle, it's going to have to revive and revise its thinking about the termination of anything. We are going to come face to face with the problem of an eternal existence in an eternal creation, ever changing but never ceasing. The lack of this concept of life after death has certainly contributed very largely to the rise of crime and delinquency in the world in the last 15 years. We might have endured it because other people's deaths we read about, and our own we do not any longer talk about, because we are not in any position to. But in the problem of a great world catastrophe, in which perhaps millions of human beings will be the instantaneous victims of sublime progress, these things get to be important. And the question is, if the bomb hits, where do we go from here? Someone has to find the answer. If we do not find an answer, we're going to fall into a chaos, the same kind of chaos that was typified in a small symbolic way by the man standing at the front of his fallout shelter with the shotgun to keep other people out. This is about all we've been trained to do. But this becomes an intolerable state of affairs, utterly unworthy of a human being. So, science is now wrestling with the reason for itself. What has the whole development of science meant if man has no existence other than the few years that he spends here? The next thing that science is going to have to struggle with, and struggle with rather seriously, is the problem of what constitutes morality and ethics. What is a good man? In all our excitement, we haven't gotten around to this yet. We know what makes smart men, but we do not know what makes good men. We have faith in good men, but we're afraid of smart men. And we have too many people to be afraid of these days. So what is this better type of being, this better type of person that we would all like to see in high office or to see in some way in authority to regulate the affairs of mankind? We know that down through time we seem to have produced some persons whom we consider better types of people. We also know by looking into the lives of these better types of people that they had strong internal characters, that they were people of faith, of vision, of insight, of courage, of unselfishness, and most perhaps important to us, of honor. Thus, the better type of person begins to emerge as an archetype in this confusion. And even science now, particularly psychology, is beginning to talk about complete people. No longer people walking around on one leg or with one arm or with one eye. In other words, people who have been rescued from intellectual and scientific surrealism. We are not very fond of some of the kinds of paintings that we see where we can't tell whether it's a human being or an omelet. And as we look inside of ourselves psychologically, we cannot always be sure whether we are human beings or omelets. And this is not any longer satisfactory. So we begin to think of complete people. And when we think of complete people, who do we think about? I don't think we think of Sigmund Freud. I doubt very much if we think of Adolf Hitler. And I'm reasonably certain that we don't think of Mr. Khrushchev. When we think of complete people, we think of those noblest examples of man, who in character, in principles, in integrities, and in values, were the archetypes of what we know all human beings should be. Therefore, perhaps we think of Jesus or Buddha, or Zoroaster, or Confucius, or Lao Tzu, Socrates, Plato, Pythagoras. These were the people, to our thinking, who were most nearly complete people. We have a different way of defining them now, but the substance is not essentially different. To us, a complete person is one who is able to administer his own life with dignity. A complete person is one who has his job and his friends, his joys, his love, his health, and the respect of his fellow men. This complete person is not merely a scientist. He may not be lacking in science, but if he's a scientist, he may be also a musician, a great lover of art, a great student of culture. He may find not only the joy of exploring space, but the quiet enjoyment of reading a great poem. This complete person is one who lives a full life, a life enriched by all forms of evidence which improve conduct and character. So we're looking for this kind of person. And we know that we cannot find him unless we create him. Buddha is very clear on this point, and no thought was ever more honest, that every individual has to be the sculptor of his own character, that he has to find ways to develop those values which are necessary. His educational system, his environment, and his society are expected to encourage in him the fullest development of his own character. If these institutions fail to so encourage him, they fail in their own purpose. A man has a right to change, correct, or if necessary, remove that which is no longer useful to him. So the search for the complete person is on. And perhaps the reason it is coming so directly to our attention is this tremendous increase in neurosis. And neurotics are not people who have simply gotten sick for no good reason. Most of them have hurt themselves, that there is no doubt. But most of the hurt is also due to the fact that they never had the equipment necessary to help themselves. Every social inducement was to make them sick, none to help them to be well. This has to be changed. And we have to find that this search for the complete person is the most practical thing in the world, because it is this person who must administer progress. This is the person into whose hands the secrets of universal energy must pass. And these hands must be pure of those defilements by which perversion is likely to be possible. So science, looking to its own salvation, has no salvation but ethics. And ethics depends upon philosophy. And all these must hasten to the aid of science, or science is going to fall apart from its own one-pointedness, from its own insistence, its own fanatical determination that science and science alone shall become the arbiter of man's destiny. It simply is incapable of this function. It is acknowledgedly only one part of knowledge, and it is trying to usurp all of the world of knowledge, which it is not capable of usurping and not able to administer. So to get out of its dilemma, science is willing again to give a second look at this crazy old institution called religion. It is beginning to recognize the need for this. We are, of course, going to be able to build a great deal of a broader religious concept out of the very findings of our times. But these findings, again, have to do principally, strangely enough, with space. All of the findings of science put together have contributed practically nothing to our moral growth. And all of the techniques of science have contributed very little to the technique for the improvement of man himself as a person. So we haven't the wide and wonderful choice in this area that we might have in some others. If we want to find a better electric toaster, we can choose from 50 blends. We have brands of every type and kind. But when we want to choose from a better way of life, we cannot choose from contemporary knowledge because it simply is not available. Almost everything worth knowing on that subject belongs to periods long remote. At some remote time, man seemed to be really concerned with living. And we must apparently turn to those times for our encouragement and inspiration in this emergency. There has been very little added to man's spiritual knowledge of his own needs or of spiritual solutions to those needs in the last 15 centuries. There have been minor contributions, but the great work was done long before that even. And on those foundations, we must find something that is suitable to our needs. It is obvious that probably the only answers that we have lie in religious doctrines which were not overly theistic in their own time, but were strictly humanitarian and strictly utilitarian. We are not going to be able to go back to the old gods, but we must go back to the systems which gave us the strongest defenses against the dangers of the unknown and the misused. And, of course, I have always felt rather strongly that one of our best sources of information on this subject was Buddha. The first place, he has been called an atheist. He has been called an atheist because he held very largely the exact point that is now coming out, namely, that the universe is under the rulership, under the leadership of one vast eternal consciousness. What he said in his time almost parallels the elite corps of Russian scientists. He did not wish to become involved in theology, and he never was. He gave to his followers a simple formula, namely that the universe is a vast instrument for the maturing and developing of the inner life of man. That this inner life, as we call it, is the real life. That it is the development of this inner life that preserves the outer world in which we live. And to the degree that the inner life fails, human society also fails. For this reason, everything depends upon the individual developing an internal sense of value. To respect that which is most worthy of respect. To venerate that which is most venerable. To conduct oneself in harmony with that which is most true and necessary. And to hold at all times that attitude which is most likely to advance the tranquility and peace of mankind. These things put together constitute a working religion. And beyond this, very little theology is necessary. For it is up to man now to labor with Buddha's four great truths. Man must clearly understand and solve for all times these four truths. The noble truth of the cause of suffering. The noble truth of the end of suffering. The noble truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering. And the noble truth of suffering itself, apart from all other conditions. Man is suffering. The world is suffering. Society is in the striving of a great suffering. Mental emotional sickness is suffering. World famine is suffering. World bigotry and persecution, these are suffering. Everywhere today, the individual seems to be getting along, but the vast body of society is in a great pain, a pain which is breaking through in every level of our living. This problem has to be solved. We must face the fact that until we end suffering, we have never perfected science. That science is not merely to give more luxuries to those who can afford them and leave suffering untouched. Science is not going to be able to solve anything by being the first on the moon, but the last to remove the causes of common suffering on earth. We like to think that science wants to cure suffering. And in the last 25 years, there has been great progress in the healing of disease. We have remedies for many ailments that we never previously were able to cope with. We are able to lengthen life considerably over the probabilities of 20 years ago. But we haven't touched suffering. For every new step in our way confronts us with new pain. And those who have lived a little longer have in most cases only suffered a little longer. The great cause of the whole problem has never been faced. Our religious life, then, must be concerned with these truths: the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the end of suffering, and the truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering. Until this is achieved, man can never build his golden age, or can never arrive at the time of peace and security he hopes for. These problems are both scientific and religious problems. Therefore, on this level, science and religion serve one purpose. There is no dichotomy. On this level, the goals of both are the same. For it is the end of both science and religion to discover the means to bring about the end of suffering. Now, this is all types of suffering: mental anguish, emotional anguish, poverty, sickness, crime, everything that we know. For in fact and truth, to have come as far in certain forms of knowledge as we have, and left untouched these great fountainheads of our misery, is a strange reflection upon our understanding and our character. But the end of both of these great needs must be found in the area of increasing knowledge and increasing insight. If science can discover for us the conscious universe, it is then the duty of other departments to discover the will, the pleasure, the law, the needs of that conscious universe, and to obey these, and to fulfill them, and to meet them in every way possible according to the understanding and insight that we can possess. So out of this comes the full realization that science does not need to be materialistic, that there is nothing in the entire world of knowledge that forces a scientist to say, I must deny God in order to defend science. There is no reason why any man should have to say, I deny science because I believe in God. There is no possible cause for such a division. For actually, science and religion are working with the same problem and the same substances. The only difference is that one is approaching them almost completely from the level of scientific intellectualism, and the other is much more warmly moved by emotional and mystical incentives. It is probable that many scientists serve for the love of man. I believe that those who go out and give their lives in distant places or serving great epidemics or attempting to save man in disaster, these people are great unselfish persons. I believe that many scientists have as high and noble a resolution in themselves as those perhaps who have more theological affiliations. But still, for the most part, the scientist does not permit himself the warmth of a great mystical enthusiasm about life. He feels that if ever he becomes truly a lover of life, he will be a betrayer of science. This is a completely stupid attitude. Because actually, science must lead to a great, full joy of life. If the scientist cannot enjoy science, and if the religious person cannot enjoy religion, what have we left? Many scientists are moved by duty. Many religious people are moved by duty. And both these groups are made up of miserable people. It is not a problem of duty. It is a problem of simple, joyous recognition of the facts of the matter. science is not in any way required in the advancement of itself to deny the power within the scientist by which he can be a scientist. And this has really caused a lot of thought. A scientist says to himself, I am a person dedicated to science. Then he stops and says, who am I? He knows, for example, that somewhere within the mysterious recesses of the brain of Einstein, there was something that could come to amazing conclusions, and that these conclusions could later be demonstrated to be true. So that actually the great discoveries of science are not made by science. They are made by men, by human beings. They are made by people like the Pasteurs and others who have given us things we desperately needed. So actually, the reason why we have science is simply because we are alive. We have science because there is something inside of us that no one has ever been able to understand completely, by means of which we are capable of developing scientific interests and remembering a scientific education. Without this life in ourselves, there could be no science. So the scientist is confronted with the fact that he is alive. Not only that he is alive, but that he is capable of continuously learning, that more and more can come out of him at every moment. Then he looks around and perhaps a little grudgingly admits that non-scientists are also alive. This is called broad-mindedness. But he also notices among some of these non-scientists some very interesting people also. Great composers, great artists, great technicians in other areas. He finds those who are able to fashion great art and others who are able to build great industrial empires. And he realizes that all skill and all knowledge is not scientific, but that it is related to many fields of interest. But all this knowledge, all that we know, is coming from somewhere. So that we are really suspended between two unknown universes. The one on the outside that goes on and on and on to infinity, in which we are now beginning to suspect that there is an indwelling consciousness. Then we go into the universe inside of man, behind, and on and on and on backward, not only through him, but through all of his kind and all other living things, and we discover an infinite universe of things there. We find 4 billion human beings, no two alike, each with an inner life, which we cannot understand, and which is perhaps more profound than we will ever know, because at most all we can see is a fragment of what that inner life is able to release into expression. Just in the as in the universe, we can only see that fragment of universal procedure which we can comprehend. So we have an infinitude at both extremes, and it is one infinity. We have, therefore, not only the problem of the consciousness lurking in space, we have the problem of the consciousness lurking in the infinite potential of man's own existence, a consciousness that is bursting through man as radiantly as any sun bursting through the walls of space. So we have not only to assume that somewhere in the furthermost is consciousness, but we must begin to assume that somewhere in the innermost is consciousness. That these two so-called divided things are really only one thing. That the innermost and the outermost are the same thing. That most of what's in between belongs there also, in these vast categories. Science must consequently assume not only the existence of consciousness in space, but must admit it in man. If he does not, then he has no way to explain the fact that he is a scientist or capable of being anything. These thoughts are rather diverting. We don't ponder them much because you can't bottle them and sell them for $15. We don't see immediate profit from this. There's certain satisfaction being the first on the moon, but there doesn't seem to be much glory in being the first person in the neighborhood with common sense. This isn't glamorous. So we continue to go into these other things and neglect this primary thing, which is the instrument of our own integration. Out of it all, science must finally wake up, as has become a trend, not only in Europe but here, to the restoration of a religion that is exactly what man needs. This type of a religion cannot be under the domination of science. We cannot put man's name in a machine and have his proper theology come out the other end. We do, however, need to realize that his theological needs, his religious requirements, have as a framework or as a pattern a very important ingredient. Whenever we find out what his needs really are, we will probably find the truth. This is what the ancients decided. Namely, that if you ever understand man, the rest of the mystery is solved. And that you can approach it from the other end, which we have been doing, trying to explain the universe first and then assume that it will answer the question about man. But the universe is too big to be explained by the facilities which we possess. We can keep on prying into the mystery, but we're not going to arrive very soon. We can, however, arrive much more rapidly at the simple conclusion of what man needs, and in this way, in all probability, discover the fact as it is. Whatever puts man in order will be the same force that keeps the universe in order. So we begin to look for this, and we come to the conclusion that over all skills, over all artistries, over all scientific facts, there is a thing which we can call purpose. Without purpose, everything else is meaningless. With purpose, everything else is meaningful. Consequently, what we must bestow upon man is what we know the universe must have, and that is purpose. We cannot contemplate the vastness of space with its infinite machinery infinitely operating without the natural and inevitable conclusion that there is a reason for it. It is absolutely inconceivable that a thing of the magnitude of the world as we begin to see it could possibly exist without a reason, without some purpose that has to be achieved. And we also suspect that down through the infinite vistas of aeons, the universe has been moving relentlessly and inevitably toward that purpose. And that the endless transformations everywhere present in the small part of the universe that we can understand, these transformations are parts of the fulfillment of that purpose. These transformations themselves are orderly, reasonable, and have obviously a purpose even in the small world of our understanding. So we now conceive, as science is beginning to conceive, a purposed universe. This is fine. We're gaining on it rapidly. But now we have another problem. We've got to find the purposeful man. We have got to discover the purpose for man. It's not possible to conceive that he is the only thing in the universe without a purpose. Sometimes it seems that he might be, but we consider this negative thinking. Actually, man has a purpose. Now, what that purpose is, may or may not be easy to discover. Perhaps that purpose rests in the infinite consciousness, and only the infinite can fully know. If this be true, then we have only one choice, and that is to accept the infinite purpose, following it without knowing, but simply by the simplest process possible, and that is by obeying. If we are part of a universal purpose, and it has its own way, then the only thing we can do is cooperate. And until we are able to fully understand, we can only help as best we can. We're not going to be called upon at the moment to help maintain the equilibrium of the galaxy. That's obvious. But it may be that it is our natural and proper demand, perfectly reasonable in nature, that we do help to advance the purposes of known things and known purposes which we do understand, and which obviously and reasonably may be said to be supporting the universal purpose. So we say, how can we know this? What part of universal purpose can we understand? What do we make out of all this vast body of phenomena in terms of a purposed plan? And when we look around for an answer, we look right straight at a scientist. And he kind of blushes a little around the ears, because he doesn't know either. The thing he should have been doing was find this out. That was the end of science. That was the purpose for science, was that science should bring to man a clear insight into the operation of universal procedure. And science's duty was to continually remind man that knowledge is only useful to the degree that it directs man in the advancement of his own destiny. So science should have given us by now a rather thorough concept of the universal code of ethics. What would be certainly true in nature, what would be inevitably true about those principles of nature with which the scientist is becoming increasingly familiar. But he remains worried only about gravity and things of this nature, when he should be worrying about meaning, about the interpretation of all that he can learn to the immediate need of all who stand waiting for understanding. Once you have come to the conclusion of the purposed universe, and there has to be a purpose, it isn't even safe to assume that there isn't. And we then stand in the immediate need of our own purpose. Why are we here? Well, we've had a lot of good philosophical thoughts on this subject. Some feel that we are here to pay our old debts. Others feel that we are here primarily to make new debts. And this is very fashionable under the extended credit system. But everyone who has thought at all has come to the conclusion that we're here for some reason. The essential reason for all existence, apparently, is in nature, is that it shall be fruitful, that it shall fill its harvest, that it shall grow up to its maturity, and then it shall bear its fruit according to its nature. And if it bears not good fruit, it shall be cast into the fire. This is what the good old hellfire and damnation artist told us about it. One thing, if either a man must be fruitful in some way, or his life is not complete. He must create something. He must leave some testimony to his own maturity. He must grow. He must increase in knowledge and understanding. He must become more capable of handling his own life more wisely and efficiently. If he does not achieve some of these things, he regards himself pretty much a failure. The man's purpose is in some way bound to universal purpose. And today, the great knowledge must be the knowledge of this purpose. When we understand man's purpose, when we understand the laws by which man can achieve his purpose, and in which he can become aware of the vast and noble destiny which is his proper place in a program of eternal progress, he will have the elements of a new religion. He will have the religion of obedience. He will have the religion of admitting the universal plan and the universal planner. He will also realize what constitutes true religion. That is, keeping the laws, which he calls the laws of God, but which we can call just as well the laws of consciousness. So religion becomes obeying the universal consciousness under which and in which we exist. If we learn to obey this consciousness, it will serve and sustain us in our normal emergencies. We've already observed and proven beyond reasonable doubt that misery results from disobedience. We have held that disobedience is due to ignorance. We are now reaching a point where we can no longer fall back upon that fib because it isn't true. It is not any longer a matter of our ignorance. It is a matter of our indifference or our misunderstanding of common things. Under such conditions, I think we can rather safely even restore the dignity of prayer. We can restore the rights of meditation and quietude. We can begin to appreciate, perhaps, the relationship of the religion of tomorrow, science, and Zen. Where in Zen we have a very good example. Perhaps not the one that we will follow, but a very good example of a simple faith that no scientist can disprove, and very few scientists have ever attacked, and a faith which is comparatively free from all superstitions, and yet strangely is strong and devout in its influence upon the life of the individual, helping him to make a closer allegiance between his own consciousness and universal consciousness. The end of all religious hope and religious life is that man shall know God, that man shall thereby experience identity with that universal consciousness which science is beginning to discover. Now, there must be ways of doing this. Science could do a great deal in problems of methodology. It could help us to avoid and eliminate mistakes. It could help us to understand and render more reasonable and purposeful the codes of life by which we live. Science can prove to us much more easily than any other branch of learning why dishonesty does not pay. Science can prove to us why hatred kills. These things science can prove. And under the proof of these things, properly presented, man will begin to understand a little better the integrities of the universe. And as science sweeps away certain superstitions that probably have been outgrown, it only clears the way for a clearer and truer and more complete insight about the essentials of the divine plan. Let us hope, then, that in the next 5 or 10 years, this trend will gain greater momentum, that the scientist will proudly affirm his belief in a divine power at the source of life, that we will have our young people brought up in this positive content, that they live in a world ruled by principles, that they are ruled not by blind forces or machines or devices created in a laboratory, that we are not going to become a universe of Flash Gordons. We are going to become a universe of enlightened persons who begin to see the universe in its true splendor, who begin to recognize that truly creation itself is the living temple, and that before the wonders of this creation, both the scientist and the common man, so to say, the unschooled or untutored one, both must fall on their knees in the adoration of that which alone is real. There is no reason why this cannot happen. The only thing is, science will have to get over some of its prejudices and its bigotries. Religion will have to get over some of its fanaticisms and its restrictions. And we're going to have to face the future together, convinced that in this future we are not going to be led into a materialistic slough of despond. We are going to be led more and more directly towards the mystery of this radiant, conscious universe. If we had only been better prepared, if our ethics and morality had been cultured and schooled first, we would now be a long way on our way toward world peace. Instead of that, we are standing in a great emergency. But even in this emergency, we must still live in a universe ruled by universal consciousness. We must try to find our place in it. We must try to inspire others to do the same. And we must more and more demand of science, wherever possible, that it provide us with what we really need, which we need more than pills and capsules. And this thing that we most seriously and completely need is hope, faith in purpose, conviction that this universe is what sciences are beginning to realize it is, something so magnificent, so inwardly and outwardly wonderful, so certain, firm, true, and inevitable, that we no longer have to live in these fears, that we no longer have to doubt everything. We no longer have to tear ourselves to pieces with our little allegiances and disagreements here, but we could live and can live in the wonderful coordination and unification of universal purpose. This attitude will have to grow. Otherwise, we will have no end to sickness, no end to the problems of our generation. Thus, it seems definitely to me that we really have no serious problem here. The great problem is that two kinds of people are going to have to wake up. The scientist is going to have to admit what his consciousness inside has always told him, and what he has battled desperately to deny, and that is that there is a great truth, and that this great truth rules the universe. And other people are going to have to get over a lot of limitations and mistakes which they have made. They're going to have to get over the importance of creed. They're going to have to look straight into the face of the sun, if they can, or certainly into the great sky at night. And they're going to say, which of these stars belongs to this church and which belongs to that one? And they're going to suddenly realize that even as high above the earth as our astronaut recently attained, it makes no difference. That these things are not important. People say that they are important because their belief is right and somebody else's belief is wrong. We must gradually rise above this wrongness and rightness of things. We must move victoriously towards, again, this unity in which wrongness ceases and only rightness remains. And all these different groups are going to finally be forced to take their stand firmly on this universal consciousness, that there is this divine power at the source of life, and that religion is to love and serve that power. And that this area of service includes the service of our fellow men, in whom also this spark of the universal is forever present. There will no longer be any need for debate, for discussion, or for creedal restriction. Rather, all attention, energy, time, effort, and thought should be directed toward the greater understanding of this principle. We should not be wasting time arguing with people of other beliefs. We should be wasting our time, if we must waste it at all, in the quietudes and relaxations of our lives. Our real purpose is not to waste time. Our purpose is to use time. When we use time to strengthen the conviction of truth in ourselves, we use it wisely. When we use time to try to break down the convictions of other men, we use it unwisely. So out of all of the creeds and doctrines and sects which have more or less prevented religion from ever being able to recognize its own universality, must come this better thing, and the faith that knowledge is a universal, that knowledge has broken itself up, that only by the reintegration of knowledge can it reveal its own universality, that religion is a universal that has been broken up into creeds, and that only by the restoration of its own unity can its universal be released. And man himself is a universal who has been divided artificially and arbitrarily by race and creed and doctrine and dogma and geographical location and languages and beliefs. All these things have broken up the universality in man and left him victim of the greatest adversary of all, diversity. But when the universality in man, the universality in knowledge, the universality in faith face head-on the universality in space, they're going to discover it is all one thing. But it is only when they attain a certain universal insight that they can unite themselves with that which possesses universal insight. Science must know this, should know it already from its own numerous experiments. But it is coming, and the day will certainly come when we will wonder how a very short-sighted world could ever have supposed that science had to be materialistic or would even choose to be. And it could only say that things like that could happen only in a dark age of some kind. Let us hope we are coming into an age of light.